Alcoholic. Alimony skipper. Deadbeat. Unreliable host. Miserable bastard. These are some of the many things that Bat Segundo is, or that you thought that Bat Segundo was. Oh, but there's more. Bat Segundo's new biography, Batting the Bat Out of Hell, is now available in stores and tells the story of a man who washed away a lucrative career in radio to introduce interviews, but who has never bothered to conduct them. Which I'm sure we can all agree is a pretty ridiculous way to make a little money. Which is why we have failed to pay Mr. Segundo for his labor. But enough about his trivial book. Let us clear the stage for a far more important person who has a more important book. A remarkable human being whose water pail I cannot carry. Whose shoes I must not wear. Whose underwear I must not touch. And who has more going on inside his head on a single day than most of us think and conceive in a lifetime. I must not utter his name, but he needs no introduction.
Okay, so I'm here with James Lipton, who is the author of Mirrors, An Exaltation of Larks, and most recently, Inside Inside. Jim, how are you doing today?
Very, very well, thank you.
Okay, I actually wanted to sort of ask you about the sort of title of this book, Inside Inside. There's a good deal of this book is devoted to your particular life, and I'm wondering, did you have difficulties getting to the Inside the Actor's Studio portion, which takes up the dominant part of the second half, or was it a matter of just you right in the very beginning that you had sort of problems to actually going ahead and not using the word I in this book, so...
Well, as you know, on the first page, I say I made myself a promise that I wouldn't begin this book with the word I.
Yeah.
And I've already violated it four times, or whatever I said there. And I explain that, like David Copperfield in that book, in his very first words, when he says, whether I shall be the hero of this book or whether that will be other people, these pages will show, I was determined that I would follow that same path, that I would not be the hero of the book, but that it would be about the heroes of my life. And I begin the book, actually, I don't begin the book with me. I begin the book with a rather long dissertation on the creation of the Actors Studio Drama School. I was involved in it. It was my idea from the beginning. I was its founding dean, but it is about a great many people, all the people who led to that moment when we introduced ourselves to the first master's degree candidates of our school. That encompasses the first chapter of the book. I immediately get into another subject. I say, okay, what's this thing called the method, and why should anybody give a rat's?
You can say whatever you want on this thing. So.
Okay, all right. And I then immediately switch gears, and in the second chapter, I say, okay, what's this thing called the method, and why should anybody give a rat's ass about it? And then there's a long disquisition on the subject of acting, of the Stanislavski system, of its history, of the studio's history. So I really don't get around to myself for quite a long while. Mm-hmm. I bring us right to the moment when we admitted our first class in 1994. And it's only then that I consider doubling back to explain how I got to that moment and to the Actors Studio and to the Actors Studio Drama School as its dean and to Inside the Actors Studio. So there's a perhaps insufficiently modest but at least reasonable gap between my disclaimer that it will be solely about myself, it isn't in any event solely about myself, and the moment when I actually begin to tell my own story.
Yeah. I'm also curious as to why you're fond of describing throwing many of these various people out. I think I counted at least 10 times where you describe throwing Spielberg out or throwing Hopkins out or that kind of thing. Do you get a sort of perverse pleasure from throwing people out?
No. All I was trying to demonstrate at that point was that this school and the forum, the seminar, that the public knows is Inside the Actors Studio is nothing more nor less than a course in the master's degree program of the Actors Studio Drama School, and that these people generously come. They get paid nothing. They're not there to plug a movie. They come there solely because I said in my letter, will you come and teach our students? And that it is such a hypnotic experience for them, such a mesmerizing experience to be face-to-face with those master's degree candidates who are very smart, who have been picked by us out of hundreds of candidates, who come from all over the world because we're in 125 countries with the show, that they become so obsessed with the process of teaching the students. That's the last part of each show. It's the last part of each evening. For an hour or two, the students ask questions and the guests answer them. And all I was trying to demonstrate was that they are with me for 5 or 6 hours and that literally, if we would let them, they would stay all night. And of course, the students would too, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
To be with Barbara Streisand for a long, long time, or Spielberg, or Billy Joel, or Tony Hopkins, or Dustin Hoffman, all of whom just kept going. And until finally, at 12:30 in the morning, I said, look, these kids have to go to class in a few hours. Get the hell out of here. And there was no perverse pleasure in throwing them out. It wasn't trying to exercise any authority or command over them. To the contrary, I'd have stayed there all night if we could have. But there were limits. And I warned them, by the way, when they arrived. I said, look, these students are very, very interesting. And when you get into the classroom session, you're going to want to stay for a very long time. Yeah. But you have to work tomorrow. You have to get up and shoot your movie or whatever they're doing in New York that brings them here. And so I say, be aware that you're going to be in the grip of something. Yeah. When Tom Hanks arrived in the green room, he said that Steven Spielberg, who had been there a couple of months earlier and who had urged him to come for the experience, he said, Steven told me, wait till you meet the students. I said, he's right. You'll have to discipline yourself because you'll want to stay all night.
Do you think it's really the students that keeps these various guests and actors kind of hardwired like this in terms of wanting to just keep on going and keep on going? Is it really the audience component or is it the teaching component? If you had to boil it down to one particular thing, what would it be?
I think it's the dynamic between them and the students. It's a different audience. It really is a different audience. It's not anything they're accustomed to. And the students are there for a particular reason, because they are pursuing this craft. They're learning it. 3-year MFA. They're master's degree candidates, actors, writers, and directors. And here's somebody who has traversed the terrain into which they will be intrepidly and perhaps anxiously entering when they receive their master's degrees from us and from Pace University. And it's a unique relationship. The students are very eager to learn, and the more eager they are to learn, this won't come as a surprise to anyone, the more eager the guests are to convey to them whatever it is they're after. So everybody has enjoyed the classroom session. I've had, I guess now, 219 guests, and I've never once had a complaint about either the first part with me or the second part with the students. They come away very, very content, because we created something that was, I think, unique. I'm not saying any of this is good. I'm not saying any of this is better than what other people do. I'm only saying that it is unlike what most other people do and unlike what my guests are accustomed to.
Yeah, if this is not better than what other people do, are there things that you are still trying to work on in terms of this format, that things you feel could be improved with what you do right now?
Well, we've improved ourselves technologically, for sure.
Yeah.
When we brought our school into Pace University, and we then acquired also the use of that extraordinary theaters, 743 seats and a full stage house with flies and wings, and we built ourselves a set with an enormous screen where we could actually, for the first time, project the scenes that we were talking about formerly in a limbo. We can project them right there in the theater. The guests get to watch themselves up there. The students get to watch the guests watching themselves. And we can talk about something that everybody has just seen. This is all brand new. This isn't us saying, okay, let's roll the tape And then on little tiny screens, people crane to see something that we're talking about. No, it's now part of the show. This is an enormous advance for us. And I give all the credit, not to myself, but to Sabrina Fodor, our producer, our line producer, and Jeff Wirtz, our director.
I'm curious as to the desk component and the blue cards component. Yeah. I mean, a lot of interview shows tend to use desks, and this was not necessarily always the case, particularly in the 70s, where there was more of a kind of open environment in which it was chairs and tables. I think of, like, Mike Douglas and Dick Cavett and the like. Yeah. I'm wondering why you chose the desk and sitting behind this desk to kind of, I mean, if this is an intimate kind of environment, it seems to me that if, you know, here we are actually sitting in this kind of tables only.
Well, we have to put someplace. We have to have someplace to put these microphones.
Oh, of course, of course, of course.
But again, you have to realize something. This was born in a classroom. You look at the first couple of years. We were sitting in two chairs that we used to swipe out of the classroom for every show. Mm-hmm. The table was a table from the green room that normally held a telephone. It was everything was improvised. Other shows have very elaborate arrangements. Frequently, when you see those desks, when you watch the news anchors, if you look at the top of the desk, you'll see that it's nothing but windows. Yeah. And underneath those windows are screens, and there's material rolling. Yeah. There's their dialogue, their brilliant aperçu, their inspirations are all rolling in front of them underneath that desk. I mean, my hat's off to them. I wouldn't be able to do that. I'd stumble all over the place. They're very clever. Or on other shows, there are cue cards out there. We don't have any of those advantages. We never did. We had to make do. We were poor as church mice in the beginning. And I said, well, we'll have a table. And since I knew that there wasn't going to be a pre-interview, which was crucial to this show, that meant I had to do all the homework myself. And that for 2 weeks before each show, 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, Saturdays and Sundays included, I would prepare these blue cards. Now I can do it on a computer. I used to sit at this table where we're sitting now and cut it out of old newspapers and journals and magazines and paste it down with scotch tape and write by hand my questions around it. Now, thank God, I can do it in a computer, thanks to a very clever fellow named Jeremy Kerrigan, who's a graduate of our school, a playwright, and who provides me with the wherewithal, the raw material.
Why blue cards over any other particular cards? Why not just regular 3x5 cards?
White flares on television.
Ah, of course. Of course. Okay. What was I going to ask you? Oh, I wanted to actually ask you if any of your training with Stella Adler has actually helped you as an interviewer.
I believe that it has. I'm not saying I'm a good interviewer, so that's for you to judge. But I came to it from several directions. First, as you know, I was originally going to be a lawyer when I went to university. And I brought with me from the art of cross-examination only one thing. The great maxim for litigators, never ask a witness a question the answer to which you do not already know. The most famous instance of somebody violating that was O.J. Simpson and the gloves. So that's part of it. And then the other part of it is, wait, I'm going to back up.
No worries.
That's all right, because I want to say something slightly different. And then the other part of it is really not a technique that Stella taught, but that Lee Strasberg taught at the Actors Studio. I never studied with him. I was never privileged to study with him, a great teacher. And that was the use of emotional memory, of affective memory. And it's a way of invoking the past in an actor. That's an element of it, too. Because when I ask people for the most significant moments in their lives, the moments that shaped them as people, as artists, which is all the program is about, nothing else. If I were to ask you to tell me the moment or moments in your life that were turning points, that led you finally to be sitting here doing what you're doing, talking to me now, you would begin to sense something. You would feel something. You would notice something. If they were the significant moments in your life, in your training perhaps, or in your career, or in your life, And when you begin to describe these nodal points, these turning points, you begin to experience something. And it's not an exercise, it's not an acting exercise. I'm not asking people to act. To the contrary, I'm asking them to be themselves. But that, if you say that the acting training plays a role, I would say that more than anything I learned from Stella, although I learned a great deal from Stella, and she was the best teacher I ever had in my life. Nevertheless, what I'm asking people to do is to describe to our students, not to me, to our master's degree candidates, and then beyond them, to 84 million homes in America and 125 countries, those moments that meant the most to them, that shaped them, that changed them, that scared them or inspired them, those people who inspired them, etc. And in doing so, it really all has to do with craft, it really does, and in doing so, by sheer happenstance, by absolute mistake, I blew the door off the hinges of this show. I thought we would be very dull. I thought we'd be very dry at the beginning, and that we would have maybe 5,000 loyal viewers. When we started, Cablevision was a small network. They owned Bravo. And we, to the contrary, what happened was, I discovered to my astonishment that when I ask people about the things that mean the most to them, the things that actually change their lives, shape them, turn them in a new direction, that in describing them to the students, they begin to relive whatever it was they felt once upon a time. And sometimes the resultant flood of emotion, and I mean flood, is not at all dissimilar from the exercise that Strasberg called emotional memory or affective memory or sense memory, because what you're talking about is what you recall through your five senses: hearing, seeing, what did the room smell like, was it light or dark, what was the other person wearing. That's an affective memory exercise. We don't do that. I don't mess around with people's lives. But at the same time, I believe that when my guests are talking about the things that meant the most to them, there is always a possibility, and frequently the occurrence, of something meaningful and sometimes very, very emotional.
Hmm. You mentioned this cross-examination at the beginning of this answer, of not wanting to ask questions that you don't know the answer to, and yet we're talking about this emotion. There have been unpredictable moments on your show.
They're the best.
Yeah.
They're the best. The all that means, that lawyer's dictum, is prepare, prepare, prepare. Once you've prepared, once I have 400 blue cards sitting in front of me, if you, as my guest, suddenly veer and I see you going in a new direction, I'm the happiest host on earth. Mm. That's the best moment for me.
But you also note in this book that you actually talk to the guests in the green room and you ask them if there are certain topics that you can or cannot talk about. Do you think that this kind of maybe gets in the way of the full expanse of expressing
no,
the answer?
No, it isn't. Then you've misread me in the book, or I've misspoken. Okay. I don't ask them if there's anything they don't want to talk about. Often the managers or the PR people of artists, of stars, on a campaign, on a tour for a movie or whatever, will provide the host of a talk show with a list of things. This is what the guest will talk about. This is what the guest will not talk about. I have never once been provided with such a list. No, what I'll do is, and I explain this in the book, and I think this is what you're referring to, if I'm going to ask somebody to do something like, I know that they can dance. I want them to dance for the students. I'll ask them about that. Do you want to dance? And maybe they got a bad knee. Maybe they just don't like to dance in public. I'll say, do you mind if I ask you to dance? Or if they mimic, I'll say, do you mind? I'd like to, for example, Billy Crystal, when he was on, I said, I would like to interview your characters. May I do that? That was the first time it ever came up. And Billy looked at me and he said, well, I said, it's okay. My feelings won't be hurt if you say you don't want to improvise with me. He said, well, listen, you're a member of the Actors Studio. If you can't improvise, who can? And so we were off. And that launched it. And that permitted me then to interview Mike Myers' characters. That was a night that was, for our viewers, unforgettable, for good reason. I mean, it was, especially with the comedians, these people are possessed, and not possessed by the devil. They're possessed by a kind of genius that the rest of us don't own. We just don't have it. And I've had very, very interesting discussions with them on our stage about how they do it. The result with Robin Williams was the most famous 5 minutes in the history of the show, when he said, I can't describe it to you, but I'll try and show it to you. Went down to the foot of the stage, saw a beautiful young woman with a pink pashmina wrapped around her shoulders, and he said, may I have your scarf? And she gave it to him. And he then did 5 minutes of improvisation with that shawl, whatever you call a pashmina, that was beyond inspiration. It was it was frightening, inspiring. It was daunting. You just couldn't comprehend how his mind was moving at that speed. That's warp speed. We'd finish one improvisation with it, and in a split second, he had morphed into somebody else doing something entirely different with the pashmina. And there's a picture in the book of the last moment, which was, I thought, the most inspired moment in comedy I've ever seen in my life, when he folded it and it had a fringe on it and he waved it back and forth in front of his face and his face suddenly appeared and he was a car emerging from a car wash. Well, I don't know about you, Ed, but I can't create like that. I don't know how that's done. It's a beautiful mystery, and the show has been full of those beautiful mysteries, and I hope sincerely that the book also conveys those mysteries.
You just told me essentially that you don't know how Robin Williams would do something like that. Is there sort of a part of you when you actually conduct these interviews in terms of, you know, I mean, you still do some acting, but I mean, maybe how does this James Lipton, the interviewer, tie in with James Lipton, the actor?
Well, when I'm interviewing Fernando, one of Billy's characters, or any of these people, any of these, whatever, Muhammad Ali, as Billy portrays him, or any of Mike Myers' characters, Linda, I'm acting. I mean, I'm not interviewing at that point. I'm being a straight man for them, and I've done a lot of it now. And we enjoy it very much. It turns out that it's something that we could do on the show that is very pleasurable for both of us.
Is this why you frequently have made appearances on The Simpsons and Saturday Night Live, that you get to kind of, I guess, play this
That's part of it, but the person who's responsible for that I pay tribute to in the book, yeah. And that's Conan O'Brien. Because Conan saw me doing that, and he began importing me. I'd get a call at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Can you be here by 4? Come over to NBC, please. And then they would have these sketches for me. I've done now about 20 of them. Yeah. And I became a kind of regular utility infielder on Conan's show. And that people saw. And that he made sometimes some very, very difficult demands on me. And we enjoyed last night. I was on his show last night talking about the book. And we have a great time together. We've turned into this odd kind of team. We both talk about it all the time to each other.
But does it trouble you to sort of be viewed as this sort of James Lipton sort of persona or archetype, or this kind of person who, as you point out in the book, in Saturday Night Live, Billy Bob Thornton actually, you know, shoots you down.
Assassinated me.
Assassinated
The Simpsons
you.
Assassinated
yeah,
me.
Yeah, exactly.
It should tell me something,
yeah,
shouldn't
well,
it?
Exactly. I mean, it seems to me that there is something, I mean, I possibly sort of, do you just happily, I guess, like, live to mock yourself in these kinds of rather dark, bleak ways, or...
I don't know the answer to that question. What I'm doing, in a sense, when I do that character, that me, on Conan or on Arrested Development or in Bewitched, yeah, with Will Ferrell, the movie, is I'm mimicking Will Ferrell mimicking me. That character is owned more by him than by me. And Will and I have talked about it. When we were about to start shooting the scene in Bewitched, in which I, as an interviewer, not as James Litton, but as an interviewer, who's unquestionably like me, begins interviewing him. It's a very important scene in the movie because Nicole Kidman sees it and it makes her angry. And the whole movie is triggered by this scene. And Nora Ephron, who was directing it, was standing at the foot of the stage. We'd shot it on my set. And Will was sitting to my left, 2 or 3 feet away, but not as me now, but as his character in Bewitched. And Nora was about to back up to the camera and let us go, and I said, "Now, Nora, because of this guy, there are two James Liptons. There's me talking to you now, like this, and there's the Will Ferrell me." And I said, "More and more I find as I play parts that what people are looking for is that even more pompous me than me. And in other words, Will's me." And I said, "I sort of now split it right down the middle. It's half him, half me. What do you want?" She said, "That's what I want." "Give me that one," she said, "right down the middle."
Is there an aspect of this Will Ferrell permutation that has actually cropped up in post-Saturday Night Live Inside the Actor's Studio segments that you sometimes rely upon as a kind of, this is something that can actually...
No.
Lie?
No, I'm not acting on Inside the Actor's Studio. I don't know. I mean, people may like or not like my persona, but it's not acting.
You mentioned a persona. I mean, you're yourself, then, you say, on Inside the Actor's Studio.
One can have a persona that is entirely oneself or not. When I'm acting sometimes, I'm acting this person who is this James Lipton in quotes. And it's become a person in demand. On Conan O'Brien last night, who was the other guest but John Cusack?
Yeah.
Who's my guest tomorrow night on Inside the Actor's Studio? John Cusack. We'd never met. Here we were meeting at Conan, and it was very amusing to both of us. And he said to me, "I'm bringing something tomorrow night. I'm bringing my new screenplay that I'm writing. It's almost complete." And he said, "I've written a role for you in it." And I said, "Offer it to me on the stage. I'll sign right there." And then I said, "I'm bringing a screenplay tomorrow night." Because when I was out in California a few days ago, my agent showed up and put in front of me a screenplay. Mm-hmm. And it's a movie called Igor.
Really?
Yes, and John smiled because it's an animated film, big animated film, and he plays Igor in it.
Oh.
And I said, she showed it to me and I. And here on the page it said, they turn on the television and there is an interviewer a la James Lipton. And I said, she said to me, "They're all over me. They want you to play this part. They'll come to New York, they'll green screen it. Will you do it?" And I said, "Okay." I said, "So we're already co-starring in something, so to speak. Yeah. My part lasts 2 minutes, and I'm the only live-action person in the movie. Everybody else is a cartoon."
Interesting. I actually was curious, because you mentioned in this book that many of the actors who've appeared on Inside the Actor's Studio appear shortly before they are nominated for Oscars or win Oscars. Do you ever feel sometimes that an actor may want to appear on your show to, I guess, appear more serious to the kind of audience that you have? I mean, that maybe...
I don't think they want to appear more serious. But I do know that we have become in the last 4 or 5 years the forum of choice. If an actor, famous or less famous, has performed so well that his or her representatives, agents, PR people think that the actor has a shot at an Oscar. Liz Smith, the columnist, wrote about it in her column a couple of years ago. She said, "It's not. They don't come here first. They don't go anywhere else. They go to Inside the Actor's Studio first."
Yeah.
Because, not because they're posing as something they're not, but because the people who watch Inside the Actor's Studio regularly in Hollywood and in New York are the voters in the Oscars. And if somebody feels that he or she has a shot, they think it's it's a good idea to appear on Inside the Actors Studio just to be seen, just to have their say on a number of subjects. Over there on the wall is a cartoon from TV Guide in which the volleyball and Tom Hanks movie when he was cast away on the island, remember, and he had a volleyball. And the volleyball is vying for the Oscar, trying to get an Oscar nomination. And it makes the obligatory stops. One of them is Inside the Actor's Studio. And the volleyball is saying to me, what I really want to do is direct.
Yeah. Nice. I'm asking this because it seems to me that, you know, you have this very, very particular format. And I'm sure that, you know, if I'm a sort of hypothetically a sort of mid-list actor hoping to become an A-list actor, I mean, yes, this is very much a sort of situation. Get on Lipton. I mean, is this a kind of consideration when you're
booking? I hope it's get on Inside the Actor's Studio, not get on Lipton.
Maybe both.
You worried
we'll,
me.
We'll go ahead and shoot both, or get on Inside the Actor's Studio. Yeah. So I mean, I guess I'm wondering is, do you, when you sign and basically get your guests lined up, do you sort of consider this kind of thing that maybe someone might be approaching you at a rather sort of punctilious time that might, or is this something that, you know, you have no problem with in terms of just like, okay, it's good for both parties?
I have one criterion, Ed. Have had since the day we opened our doors. Does this person have something to teach our students? Mm-hmm. That's all it is. And that's how I make my decisions. I'm not trying to figure them out or analyze their motives. I don't know what their motives are sometimes. Who knows? But I do know that our motive is to provide our students with a really good teacher. And that's all I know. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything else.
I'm wondering, though, because you also use a lot of major celebrities, major A-list stars, often at the sort of expense of... I mean, I looked at the latest season list, and Mark Ruffalo could probably be called sort of borderline, John Cusack possibly as well. But I'm wondering why you don't have as many character actors on your show, such as like Judy Davis or Steve Buscemi, or even actors who may have actually failed. I mean, wouldn't students actually be able to learn from people who are not a success?
Possibly. There is no question but that Inside the Actor's Studio is a television program. Bravo is a network. Bravo is gives us a great deal of latitude. Philip Seymour Hoffman was not a star yet when he appeared on the show. Mark Ruffalo is an amazing actor.
Yeah, I do too.
That's why he was on the show. Cusack is a star. Don't kid yourself, that's a major star. But, again, that's not the point. It's true. The network is very pleased when Harrison Ford shows up.
Yeah.
No question. Julia Roberts shows up. Barbara Streisand. They call me and they send me flowers and say thank you, thank you, thank you. Of course they like stars. The public likes stars. Anybody listening to this broadcast likes stars. And Steve Buscemi is a wonderful... Buscemi is a wonderful actor, but more people will watch John Travolta than Buscemi, and the networks know that. And so I have a limited number of slots. If they get filled up with the Travoltas and the Tom Cruises and the Barbara Streisands, then the network is very pleased, and that leaves less room, no question about it, for actors of the second and third rank. But that has nothing to do with criticizing their talent. We have had a number of actors who were really sort of just beginning to show signs. Benicio del Toro was not a big star when he appeared Inside the Actor's Studio. I called Bravo. I said, this guy is going to be one of the leading actors of his generation. I'm booking him. And they did not say no.
I'm just wondering, though, because, I mean, it seems to me that you have reached a point where Inside the Actor's Studio is undeniably influential. I've taken acting classes, in my brief attempt at acting, where they cited your show as one of the things to watch.
I know.
And I know that a lot of acting classes do this. So given the fact that there is this built-in audience, that you have reached a point that really, you know, you can almost have anyone on there and it's still going to be a whopping success. Do you really think it's a matter of having...
No, it's still not going to be a whopping success. television shows are watched by different numbers of people at different times. The public really does come to see stars. There's no question about it. We can't. What you just said is wonderful in an ideal universe, but it's not the case. That doesn't mean that people are barred from the show. Not at all. But it does mean that when I'm casting the show, or when PR people or agents come to us and say, "Would you like so and so?" that the ones that the network is quickest to greenlight are the most famous, are the most popular and well-known.
So the network has to greenlight each particular guest, then?
Yes, but they don't. They're very fair about it. We're not. You know, Bravo is owned by NBC Universal, but NBC, CBS, ABC, the big networks, are a good deal more demanding. If you want to be on Jay Leno or David Letterman, that casting is really vetted. And we're not vetted by the network like that. They allow me to have people that I really am very, very impressed by and who are not yet as famous as the others. But they are happier, obviously, when I say to them, "Hey, I just got a call, and Johnny Depp wants to do the show." They jump up and down for joy. They'd be fools if they didn't.
Do you have any regrets, or does it break your heart when you have to weigh one particular actor over another as to who's going to be on the show?
I don't have to weigh them. It doesn't happen that way. It isn't as though I have a list at any given moment of six people who want to do the show, and we go A, B, C, D, E, F, G. It doesn't work like that. We do a limited number of shows per year, and the casting calls may begin in August, or somebody will call in September, somebody will call in October, November, even December for the fall season. And we don't have, it's not as though we have that kind of leeway. The actors and directors, they may be in New York on a certain date. I'll get a call, "Would you like to have so-and-so on the show?" He or she will be there on December the 1st.
So is it a first-come, first-serve kind of thing?
Well, it winds up being that, you see. And because the more illustrious of the guests have been accepted, then once we're filled up, and anybody else has to wait till the next season.
Gotcha.
But I think we've had a pretty good record that way. And when I cast somebody who is not of the superstar, at the superstar level, you read those critics who say, "What is so-and-so doing on Inside the Actors Studio?" All of a sudden, the purity police come out and berate me and say, "This person is not worthy of being on Inside the Actors Studio." And I want to write them a letter and say, "Hey, I didn't notice the time when you were saying we were so marvelous that and it's such an incredible stratospheric level that only X, Y, and Z could be on the show." If the critics cast this show, you'd really have a complaint about whom they allow. Well, they're the biggest snobs of all.
You may also sort of, you know, you can make the case that critics are going to basically always value the bad over the good, maybe. I mean, they're going to, like, you know, complain off. They're going to be more vocal about their complaints than their hosannas, so to speak. So maybe that's
that,
the
that
sort
goes
of
without saying. I mean, you're right.
Actually, I wanted to ask you about the whole Bob Carey situation, which you have at the end of the book, his gutting of the Actor's Studio from the Actor's Studio Drama School. I looked into this myself. I was fascinated by the story. The New York Times reported in 2005 that this was a simple move toward more oversight and control over the program's curriculum and staffing, and Carey also insisted that he didn't want to have any connection whatsoever with Inside the Actor's Studio. I'm wondering...
No, he never said that.
That's what he said in this article I dug up in 2005, that he didn't want this to be a part of the school.
Oh, no, he did not.
Really? I was curious to clarify exactly.
Oh, no, I mean, let's be fair to the man. I mean, I'm not fond of him, but out of fairness, never, ever said that. He valued Inside the Actor's Studio. And he said I was a dean. And he said in a deans and officers meeting that Inside the Actor's Studio raised the level of the entire university, and that there were admissions in all of the divisions of the university that occurred solely because people heard and read about Inside the Actor's Studio. And when I stepped down as dean, a short time before he made his move, I received the Founders Medal. It's quoted in the book, the citation. They said that I changed the landscape, the academic landscape of the university. The Founders Medal was only given 13 times since the founding of the university. He wrote that and said that inside the Actors Studio, the words of praise for it are endless. No, whatever you recall is not the case. I have quarrels with him. That's not one.
Mm, gotcha. Do you think that television and this academic world are meant to sort of coexist like this? Or?
Sure. We're Pace University now. They're very, very happy with the school. The school is doing wonderfully. And the show is certainly doing well. And Pace University is, I think, on November 14th, we'll have they've asked me to do a book signing there, which I will do in our theater. They expect 1,000 people. I'll speak there. They gave me at the last graduation exercise an honorary doctorate, and I delivered the commencement address. So we have a very, very close and very compatible and harmonious relationship with the university. We're part of the university. Our school is a master's degree program in the university. So they are everything that we had had before Bob Carey came to the university, to New School, with Jonathan Fanton. Fanton was the president for 17 years. And if you'll notice, there's a letter in here from Jonathan Fanton saying that one of the two or three best things he did as president, this is when I received the Founders Medal, before the break. And he said was one of the two or three things that he did that he was proudest of was bringing the Actors Studio in. The Pace feels the same way. Carey had other issues.
Gotcha. I want to actually ask you about the theme of parental loss that you say is a big part of the show. I'm curious about this because if we look at the sort of statistics, so they say 50% of all marriages end in divorce and people inevitably sort of die. So is this
on my show? It's 75 or 80%.
Oh, okay.
Or death.
Well, that's the thing. Death, between death and divorce. I'm wondering if this might be sort of, I guess, an overreaching metaphor, perhaps. Or
I don't think it's an overreaching metaphor, but I think it is an overarching, as you said.
Yeah.
I think that your lapsus linguae was entirely appropriate. It is an overarching theme. There's no question about it. It's statistically so. It's undeniable. That most of the guests, and of course I include myself, and I deal with that in the book. That was one of the discoveries that I made about myself in the book, was how much I had been influenced by the departure of my father, the beatnik poet. But the that theme on my blue cards emerges time and time and time again, and has led me to believe, and it's not a provable hypothesis, I'm a philosophy nut, not a scholar, but very interested in the subject. And the logical positivists would say that that is not a provable thesis and therefore not a legitimate question to ask. But nonetheless, I believe instinctually that many, perhaps the majority of my guests, began acting in an effort somehow to demonstrate to someone now missing that they were and are worthwhile. Many of them have confirmed that.
Why do you think your show ends up getting so many emotional responses to this? I mean, you have, again, Jack Lemmon revealing he's an alcoholic, Terry Hatcher talking about being molested as a child.
The rape.
Yeah, exactly. Things like this, however, I mean, I'm wondering if they perhaps get in the way of actually discussing the craft of acting, or is it as much about discussing the person?
Oh,
I mean,
my God. You're talking about, you're talking about the formative elements of their lives. I mean, I don't care if somebody's been arrested for drunk driving. I don't care if somebody has had three extramarital affairs that were in the tabloids. I don't care about messy divorces and that kind of thing. The only, of all of those human foibles, the only one that we do deal with and have dealt with is addiction, drug and alcohol addiction, because it is so, A, prevalent, and B, so vital an element in some of the lives of my guests. Downstairs, you may have seen it, there's a beautiful plaque, the Prism Award, which is given each year to the television program in each category that has most openly and effectively and honestly faced the question of addiction. And we won it. We won it the year that we had Drew Barrymore on the show. I'm very proud of that one, very proud of it. And I must say that no guest has ever balked when the subject came up. They feel an obligation first to those master's degree candidates out there to warn them that this might lie ahead for them and that it lies in the background of the guest. And, Melanie Griffith, the book is about my heroes. She's one of my heroes. What a brave fight she's put up. She's an AA member. She goes probably three or four times a week, maybe more. She hasn't fallen off the wagon. And when she describes it in that little girl voice of hers, you want to weep. Her courage is, I think, boundless. And she talked about why she became addicted and what an addictive personality has to fight. She did that on our stage, and my hat's off to her and to each one of them who talked about it.
When did you feel that this addiction precedent was set on the program?
I beg your pardon?
When do you feel that the addiction precedent was sort of set on the program?
Really, I think it was triggered by Jack Lemmon. Goes back that far. And after that, when it came up on my blue cards, I decided that I would inquire. If they don't want to talk about it, that's the end of it. I can't force somebody to talk about something. But nobody has said, I don't want to talk about it. It's interesting, isn't it?
Well, he volunteered that information to you. That was not on the blue card.
No, it was not, because nobody in the world knew it until that moment.
Yeah.
Except his family.
Do you think that confessions along these lines from various guests kind of encourage other particular people to...
In the next room, if you go to the wall there, you'll see in the European press, I am usually identified either as the psychiatrist or the confessor. In the Catholic countries, they call me the confessor.
Yeah.
There's nothing priest-like about me. I'm not a very religious person, to say the least. But nonetheless, there is a confessional element. I know it. And it's there in the book, in Inside. There are some astonishing moments. But I should stress that nobody is more surprised by what occurs in this book than I. For me, it was a journey of discovery, and I was amazed at what I discovered in it about myself. I did not know some of the things that turned up on that screen and that are in the book. I just didn't know it. Like the child that Somerset Maugham quoted. Yeah. How do I know what I think till I see what I say? And there it is in the book. All of a sudden, on the screen, I realize, oh, that's why I did what I did, or that's what I really thought. For me, this book has been a very interesting journey. And a number of people who've written about it has had some very, very good reviews. The first three reviews, pre-pub, were wonderful. And they talked about, one of them did, as I recall, what an emotional journey it was, must have been for me, and it was.
Was this a matter of, I guess, figuring out exactly this trajectory of your own writing this book. Was really that the whole purpose of writing this
book? No, that's the point. It wasn't the purpose at all. I blundered into it. I stagger into a lot of things. I blunder into things all the time. I didn't know that we'd be the largest graduate drama school in America. I didn't know we'd be in 125 countries, we'd get 13 Emmy nominations. I didn't know any of that. Never dreamed. And I didn't know when I started writing the book that I was going to, A, discover so much, and then, B, reveal so much.
Well, like, for example, the Paris thing that everybody seems to be interested in.
They just
in.
Love it, don't they?
Well, I mean, I'm wondering, the reason that you include this particular moment, as you say in this book, is because another person wrote about this. And I'm wondering why...
Arthur Lawrence outed me.
Yeah. I'm wondering, though, why bother to, I guess, perpetuate this story when you can leave people in mystery as
Yes,
to,
but he
you know,
didn't... Well, it's not perpetuating the story, because he only told a tiny, 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 tiny bit of the story. It was the tip of the iceberg. Well, when somebody reveals the tip of the iceberg, you bloody well better go and take a look at that iceberg. Otherwise, that's the record forever. And nobody knows what the whole story is. So I decided that I would tell the whole story. I confess that I was, when I had written it, I gave it to my wife, as I gave every chapter of the book to my wife to read. And she walked into my study, and she had the pages in her hands. She said, you're not going to print this, are you? And I said, yeah, I intend to. Why shouldn't I? You can't, she said. People, what will people think of you? I said, God, Kedekai, I've spent the last dozen years trying to persuade my guests not to ask that question, what will people think of me, but rather to say what's in their hearts and on their minds, and let the devil take the hindmost. So I printed it.
Do you care what people think about you?
I suppose I do, like everyone else. I would have to be either impervious or monumentally secure not to care. I don't think that it's the first thing on my mind. When I meet someone or talk to someone, I'm not thinking, what is that person thinking of me? I think that's a dreadful mistake. Remember that when you're trained as an actor, and well-trained as an actor, what is the first thing that you eliminate? Self-consciousness. You must. I say in the book, if there is one secret to acting, it is that you must eliminate self-consciousness. Only then can you begin to do what an actor has to do in order to inhabit another character. And so I think I'm reasonably well-trained in that craft, and I hope that I'm not self-conscious. I mean, there are moments when you have to be.
Well, of course. Of course, particularly since there's this impression of you through these satirical perceptions of you, this sort of Will Ferrell you as well.
Yeah, but the Will Ferrell me is not me.
Yeah.
I mean, he's somebody who makes me laugh like hell, that me of Will Ferrell's, but he's not me. I mean, if I were to behave that way at the dinner table, my wife would ask me to leave the table. Yeah. So would my friends.
Well, Jim, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much for talking.
Thank you, Ed. I really
Thanks
appreciate
a lot.
It. More than I can tell you. Okay. Very seldom that I get to say all these things because I'm not asked about them, and I appreciate your asking.